law should be stable, but not stand still. It can't be rigidly fixed. Now, we don't want to be too quick to overturn something. You don't want to be known as a court that changes the law because of changing the judges. That's changing preferences as opposed to changing what's best for society.
Hello, I'm Shauna Van Praagh, President of the Law Commission of Canada. Welcome to Obiter, a Law Commission of Canada podcast that features discussions with people across Canada who are living law, pursuing justice, and renewing hope in creative, challenging, colorful, and complex ways. The word obiter, or phrase obiter dicta, refers to words not understood to be crucial to what a case in law stands for. It turns out that passages labeled obiter and thus overlooked sometimes become the most important or enduring. Inspired by the notion for which it is named, the Obiter podcast shines light on what might otherwise be missed or invisible in the evolution of law. In introducing listeners to a rich intersection of individuals, ideas, and issues, Obiter invites us into the many spaces in which law operates, evolves, and generates hope. Through conversations with guests who bring a wide range of experience and interests connected to law and justice, Obiter presents law reform as a collective endeavor that takes on many shapes, functions, and directions. The podcast promises to serve as a site for thoughtful reflection and active inquiry, the challenging of assumptions and the broadening of perspectives, the forging of connections and enriched understanding of the shared pursuit of justice across Canadian society. In this episode, we meet a trailblazer in law and law reform in Canada.
You never stop learning, but the most important learning I had was from my mother and father because they gave me the values of a human being by which to live.
Building justice and shaping the evolution of law is a never-ending task. That's something that Frank Iacobucci has demonstrated in different ways throughout the course of his life. A graduate of University of British Columbia and Cambridge, he began his career with a brief period as a lawyer in New York before coming back to Canada to teach law in Toronto. He became dean of the law school at the University of Toronto and then moved to university leadership before heading to Ottawa to serve as Deputy Minister of Justice, Chief Justice of the Federal Court of Canada, and then Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada from 1991 to 2004. He has been a leader, decision maker, head of review inquiries, and perhaps most notably the federal government's chief negotiator for the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. I first met Frank when I was an undergraduate student at the University of Toronto and he was university provost. That encounter began a 40-year connection marked by much valued mentorship and learning, a connection that inspired me to write a book entitled Building Justice, Frank Iacobucci and the Life Cycles of Law. Frank Iacobucci's career could be abbreviated to a more or less chronological list of positions or titles: practitioner, professor, dean, provost, deputy minister, chief justice, Supreme Court justice, university president, negotiator, arbitrator, chair. Classifying the types of roles and responsibilities Frank Iacobucci has taken on is another possibility: advocate, scholar, teacher, administrator, leader, policy advisor, decision maker. Or we could enumerate various ways in which people have addressed him over the years. Mr. Iacobucci, Professor Iacobucci, Dean Iacobucci, President Iacobucci, Deputy Minister Iacobucci, Dr. Iacobucci, Counsel, Honorable, Mr. Justice, Chief, Mr. Chair, My Lord. Here, I will invite him just to be Frank. And I am delighted and honored to welcome you, Frank, to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I wish my wife were here to hear that. It's just about as nice as I have heard, and I'm not sure I deserve, but I'll take it.
Wonderful. So I'm going to start by inviting you to tell our listeners your story of where you come from and how you ended up studying law.
Well, like so many others in our country, I'm the son of immigrants. In my case, immigrants from Italy. My father came first in 1922. He went to Vancouver from the Abruzzo region of Italy. My mother came in 1925 to Vancouver to be a part of a, well, she was slated to be married to an older man. And refused when she was only 16 years old. My father had no education, none. My mother, grade five, which was the sort of minimum age for education in Italy. But both emphasized education. And that emphasis was crucial. Although I've taken many years to get educated, and education never stops, right? As you know, as a professor, a distinguished professor of law, you never stop learning. But the most important learning I had was from my mother and father. Why? Because they gave me the values of a human being by which to live. I got to the law through basically an accident. The elementary school that I attended, the principal, at the end of our grade six, we went to a junior high school in Vancouver, but there was a little ceremony in the grade six graduating class, so to speak, and he said a few words about each of us. And about me, he said, Frank Iacobucci talks a lot, and I think he should be a lawyer. The next Angelo Branca. I had never heard of Angelo Branca. I thought he was a football player for Notre Dame or something like that. I went home, asked my father, and sure enough, my father knew him and said he's a very well-known lawyer. I tell the story because it was the seed. It's something, just that kind of a casual remark. So basically, the things that my parents didn't have the opportunity for, namely education and the law, are the two components of my career. It shows that my story is no different from millions of others. That doesn't mean it's not significant for all of us that can say we're son or daughter of immigrants. And education was, well, I believe education is the most transformative experience in life. And I don't care whether it was the training of a skill, like as my older brother pursued and achieved, or it's in the academy. And not only is career selection and involvement, but the development of the human being. What do you think of life, society, feelings and experiences that I think derive greatly from the education you have received. And the realization, along with my siblings, for what my parents came to this country for. They came not for themselves, but for the families they were to have, the children. And that's the big story of a country like Canada.
Thank you, Frank. What an inspiring way to start off our conversation, letting listeners in on a little bit of your unique story, but also reminding people that it's not so unique. It's so shared and so crucial to the building of this country. And as you say, to the importance of learning and education, and also that passing on of values from generation to generation. I'm going to invite you now to tell the story of how you almost didn't go to law school because you were hoping after that grade six graduation, you had that idea in your head, but a few years later, you were told that maybe that wasn't a dream that you could pursue.
I studied commerce at UBC as an undergraduate before going to law school. And in that commerce course, one had to take statistics, which was regarded by the commerce students as a tough course. For some reason, I fell in love with the course. It's kind of an embarrassing admission. And I was asked to be a lab instructor in it and got to know the professor, who was of Polish background. He had a funny name. His name is Matuszewski. Father was an academic at the University of London. He was at UBC, later to go to Quebec. And he took an interest in me and asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, well, I wanted to go to law school. And he said, you don't want to go to law school. This is Vancouver, 1957. I said, well, I'd like to be a lawyer. And he says, well, I don't think you should go. And I said, why? And he then said, you don't have the right name. Anyway, he then volunteered that we meet with John Deutsch, who was head of the department and later to become president or vice chancellor of Queen's University. And Deutsch was a solemn kind of figure, a wonderful reputation, and deservedly so as a civil servant and quite knowledgeable about Canadian society. And we went at the meeting and Deutsch said, I think Canada is changing. And if this young man wants to be a lawyer, if that's his passion or his desire, he should pursue it. Now, that was a turning point, because if he had said, I think you're right, I think he's got the wrong name. Here, now, this is a man named Deutsch, German-Canadian. I'm Italian-Canadian. My parents were enemy aliens during the war, had to register with the RCMP, had to show up monthly. I went as a toddler at 5 years old. I remember the visits, not vividly, but I do remember them. I went with my mother. I thought even Deutsch's advice was disquieting, because what do you mean Canada is changing? Why is one's name a barrier? Now, this is not an exaggerated story, I'm afraid to say. I found out later on, when I went to New York, the so-called melting pot is not a melting pot. There were people who were there before me who left the firm, one of them very, very preeminent, but he didn't think they would pick an Italian-American as partner. And then there was no Jewish partners except one, and my Jewish friend said to me, Frank, you're more Jewish than Len Joseph, who was the Jewish partner. I don't want to dwell on this, but history of most countries has ugly themes. And one of them is this one, namely prejudice against minorities. Women, not a minority, but probably suffered the most by far. None of those big firms, the firm I was in, second largest in the United States, the law firm, not one woman lawyer. This is 1964 to 67. So if Deutsch had said, no, you should think about another career, I would have followed that advice and not gone to law school.
Well, obviously, I asked you to share that story because it happened a number of decades ago, but it resonates for individuals and communities here in Canada, in other places. It also, dare I say it, kind of shows how you inherited a certain stubbornness, I think, from your parents also, which stood you in good stead and made you question those assumptions and realize that you as an individual could play a role in the change, in the fact that Canada was changing. You became one of the people who illustrated the ways in which Canada was changing through going ahead with your plan to go to law school, learning as a lawyer, and then going on with a law degree in hand to basically engage in ongoing change in law in all the possible ways we can imagine, which we'll talk about some of those. But I want to pick up from learning, which you've just beautifully expressed the importance of, to teaching, and the fact that you, of course, are a teacher. You taught future lawyers. You headed up a university, and that influenced your understanding of the importance of teaching and learning for change in law and society. So I wondered if you could share a little bit more about how those roles and the responsibilities that come with being a teacher and that impact that you can have on people, and also for taking on the responsibility in higher education in this country, how important all of that research and teaching and commitment to education is for generation after generation of people, whether they choose to go to law school or not, but people who will shape and contribute to change in our country.
What you have raised, Shauna, I think are extremely important points. I did touch upon education being so fundamentally transformative. Neither of us would be here without that foundation. And it isn't just about getting money to live. It is about, I think, the psychic return from teaching, the psychic return, the satisfaction is basically contributing to society through the students that you're fortunate to teach. And I don't mean in title, I don't mean in position, I mean in being good Canadians, members of their communities, contributing in a myriad of ways to the betterment of society, which is the aim of the law. But it needs actors. to execute that mission. And that psychic return from satisfaction of your students, it derives because you were part of the journey of those people in their educational period of learning. And hopefully, the one thing about the legal profession, that is the core emphasis, is helping people. You can get into religion through that. You can get into morality through that. If you like secular sort of best, it's simply that. It's helping people. I still get great satisfaction in my work if I can say I've helped a First Nation. I've helped a community. I have helped people who are vulnerable. There's nothing like it. I used to say to students that whatever you want to do with your life, it should be an equilibrium between money to survive, shelter, food, the basics. But you really also want to think about what's the satisfaction you get from whatever you're choosing. In many ways, that's more important because the survival will look after itself for the most part.
And that's a lovely connection to draw with that language of psychic return or satisfaction of teaching and that kind of ripple effect that you have on students generation after generation. And as you've just said, this commitment to helping people, which lies at the very core of a career as a jurist, as a lawyer, no matter what forms that takes on. So let's talk a little bit more about some of those forms, because you've done them all, helped people in so many ways. From the university setting, an explicit context for thinking about education and teaching, to your first position in Ottawa as Deputy Minister of Justice, you've talked about how you had a whole lot to learn as you joined the public service. This was a shift from the university to this kind of role and responsibility, and taking on this vantage point, if you like, for thinking through how law changes and how law needs to be responsive to Canadians and to the shaping of Canada as a country. So an invitation to reflect a little bit on how you saw that role and how it influenced your view of the relationship between law and government in particular.
Let me just say that this whole matter was not something I planned. This was not an option that I had on a chart. Not at all. I was in the university. I think it was the time when Prime Minister Mulroney was forming his first government, and he was looking for people from different backgrounds. And I met with two, not staff people, but politicians of his party. And they didn't mention any specific. They were sort of looking at recruiting people from outside. I got a phone call from the clerk of the Privy Council, who's the head of the civil service, if I would be deputy minister. This was some months after I met them. I made it clear to the people I met with that I'm not looking for a job. It was really a surprise. So I thought about it. Obviously, I said that I'd have to speak to my wife. This is not something one does unilaterally. So my wife, who's also a lawyer, she was all for it. I had the disadvantage of not being a member of the public service, but I was in a public service of another kind. That was really helpful. Public Service of Canada, largest employer in the country. And I was the head of the law firm. So some of the things that I had done in university were helpful in terms of leadership and your style of leadership, your substance of leadership. But it was a great opportunity to see the role of government in society, the role of the public service in that service to the people, and in particular, the role of the Justice Department in the administration of justice. So it was just invaluable to my knowledge and appreciation for what we have in our country, which is so central to our democracy. Because in the list of factors for a democracy, the role of a free, no corruption, objective public service is central to a democracy. You can have the most enlightened policies, but if it's administered by a corrupt public service, it means nothing. In fact, it means negativism, not anything that's positive. So my learning curve was steep. I worked very, very hard, probably the hardest I've ever worked. And I mean, I don't know, 90 to 100 hours a week. The learning curve was perpendicular. But it was also an advantage because I didn't know anybody, anything. I have to say it was thrilling professionally and personally. And I will go to my grave with that thought, because one of the real assets of our country is the quality and character of the public service. And I mean now the provincial public service as well as the federal public service.
The Law Commission of Canada is an independent and nonpartisan agency committed to engaging the people of Canada in the ongoing and dynamic evolution of law. We offer responsible and responsive leadership and guidance on law, justice, and the renewal of hope. To learn more about us, visit the Law Commission of Canada website or follow us on LinkedIn and X. And to learn more about this episode of Obiter and others, check out our show notes.
Frank, you talked about the central significance of the administration of justice in a democracy. And so I'm going to invite you now to another institution, also crucial, I think, to our democracy in Canada. So the bench, the judiciary. After your time as Deputy Minister of Justice, you served as Chief Justice of the Federal Court of Canada for 3 years and then headed to the Supreme Court of Canada. And your signature, if you like, on the body of work that you produced as a judge, marked by, and you tell me if you agree with this, but a commitment to dialogue, an embrace of human complexity, and a steadfast belief in human dignity. So I wondered if you could reflect a little bit on some of the particular ways in which you, and more broadly, members of the bench play a role in how law changes over time, how society evolves, and how significant our democracy is.
There is no doubt that the bench plays a central role. The description is there are three branches of government: legislature, which is what normally people think of when they think of democracy, with elected representatives representing the main focus of that democracy. But there are other features of a democracy that are absolutely essential, and one of them is an independent, impartial judiciary, because you cannot really have a democracy without the rule of law. So with the judiciary, I call it a branch, but it's not a branch of government as much as it's a branch of governance. That's my preferred word, because we're not, as judges, government people. But, and here's the big but, we should look upon our roles as part of dialogical, if you like, partners. Now, I don't mean in the usual sense of partners, but dialogical partners, because we respect the other branches, both executive and legislature. I think we should all maintain respect for each other's roles in a democracy. Much of the work of the Supreme Courts, the lower courts, can be reversed by the legislature. Much of it, the Constitution's an interpretation, that's a different matter. That can be reversed as it is if it's shown to be faulty by subsequent changes in facts or changes in knowledge or experience, and through what you are concerned with, and that is law reform. So the bench can play a major role and has to play that role, because constitutions are not like regulations to the Shipping Act or the income tax code that has to be pretty much detailed in certain ways. So the constitutions and the approach we have is that constitutions are living trees. Law should be stable, but not stand still. There's stability in the law, but goodness gracious, it can't be rigidly fixed. Most of us are uncomfortable with that, because we find out through experience or through further study and analysis that we never had before that there's another way of doing this or other ways of doing something, and we should be responsive for the betterment of society to that change in circumstances, a change in facts, and we've got many examples of it. Now, we don't want to be too quick to overturn something, because you don't want to be known as a court that changes the law because of changing the judges. If that's what you end up demonstrating, that's not what we want to have, because that's changing preferences as opposed to changing what's best for society. That's the role of judges.
I think that's a very helpful way to articulate that responsibility of members of the bench, what judges do and how they engage in these never-ending dialogues, and how they are participants in the organic nature of law. They have a very special role, and you've outlined that, but a role in partnership. And I think that that idea of partnership, of understanding these different contributions that institutions and actors are making to ongoing change, right? Uncertainty is always present and change is always possible, but respect for those frameworks that law provides or legal traditions provide also has to be there, as you've underscored. Let me shift to your role as a decision maker and listener in a different context, and that is in the quite incredible range of commissions and inquiries and reviews that you've participated in. You've been called upon time after time to bring people together to listen to what has happened in the past and to make recommendations or to provide some analysis that makes room for change as we go into the future. So, for example, your role in the review on enhancing First Nations representation on juries in Ontario, a review of police encounters with people in crisis, federal inquiry into actions of Canadian officials in relation to named detained dual citizens. Those are just some examples. And I wanted to invite you to share some reflections on that kind of work and how important and distinctive it is for Canada's commitment to justice and evolution of law.
I should have said this earlier when you were listing the positions that I've held. My mother and father were a little concerned of my changing jobs because they thought I was being forced to leave those jobs, that I couldn't hold on to any job. I jokingly say every institution's gotten stronger after I left it. But in any event, I've been lucky and fortunate. And one huge example of that fortune has been the involvement with reviews or commissions of inquiry, as you've mentioned, with every municipal, provincial, and federal. So I've seen the sort of federalism model in a very pragmatic reality, both the advantages of the system and some of the disadvantages of the framework that we have. These reviews and commissions of inquiry are, at one level, they're a form of accountability for not just the legislature, but the executive. That's a common theme. In order to do the job properly and effectively, you really need the full cooperation of the body that asks you to do the job. If you don't have that, it's very unlikely that the outcome is going to be of any great value, because people will eventually find out the defect of that shortcoming. The third thing that I would say about the reviews is that it's my view that if something is important enough to have a reviewer or independent inquiry with no strings attached and full cooperation, it shouldn't end with the report and its recommendations. And whenever I've had the opportunity, I have basically called for the government concerned or the body concerned to be transparent with the report's recommendations and undertake to report to the people the status of those recommendations, what was done and what was not done, and if it's not done, what are the reasons for not done? It isn't egotistical on my part or on others who do these reviews, because it's aimed at the transparency and accountability for the public So those are the things that come to my mind of doing these. So much of the past, you know, has been many examples of you get a hot potato. So what do? We set up a royal commission. It's almost a contagious Canadian disease of public order and public nature, public body nature. And that's not a good way to treat the subject. In other words, there's a politicization of an issue rather than really what the focus should be. What's the public interest in having this inquiry? And what is its mandate to focus on? And that brings me to another issue that I think is applicable to your world, and that is in law reform. You want to be very careful in law reform to ask the right question and narrow the mandate. Spend time on what is it the mandate you want to have to really make a difference in the legal frameworks that we have in our country or the approaches that we've taken on certain issues.
I was gearing up to ask you about the lessons for any law reform agency, and in particular, the Law Commission of Canada, and you beat me to it. I also take from what you just said the importance of not thinking of a report as the final stage, but rather an invitation to keep moving, keep thinking, keep committing to ongoing change flowing from what we can learn through a commission or a focused inquiry. I do want to give you an opportunity to talk about something that you've labeled as the most satisfying task you have had as a lawyer. And listeners may not believe this, but this one, the one that you have talked about as particularly satisfying, is your role as chief negotiator on behalf of the federal government for the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. I know that we could talk for ages and ages about this, but I want to just invite you to share with listeners a little bit about the challenges you faced and the significance of that work and how meaningful it was for you as a person, as a lawyer, as a Canadian, and of course also for the country.
Well, thank you for raising that, because as you correctly mentioned, it is something that has given me that kind of satisfaction that as a lawyer, I can't top it in my lifetime anyway. Others probably could, but in other respects, because as others have said, the mistreatment of Indigenous people is an ugly part of our history, a very ugly part. I can use other language that others have used, cultural genocide. One of the worst examples in our history. I mean, it goes on in terms of people's lives just lost, and literally lost. Yet it was an attempt to make things better. And in its own perverse way, it made things worse. I was ashamed of it as a Canadian, but I believe that through the effort of a lot of people, a few in mind that I will mention, the settlement was an attempt to, in effect, recognize how bad it was and to try to do something to respond. If you put it on a religious basis, if the sin has been committed, this was acknowledgement and redemption on that kind of approach. I say religious because, as you know, the whole system of residential schools, the policy was a federal policy and an Indian Act enforcement that children go to school to, in effect, to be assimilated, to lose their Indianness, to beat the Indianness out of the child, was a quote. I was called by the Minister of Justice, Erwin Cotler, shortly after I was finishing up my stint as interim president of the University of Toronto to do this, as they called me the federal representative. You were right. I was the chief negotiator. But that, the real, to me, a focus on how it all started, I would point to Phil Fontaine, the former national chief of the Assembly of First Nations. Without Phil Fontaine, this doesn't happen. And his now wife was also key in the articulation and participation in the negotiations that took place over a very intense period of time across the country. 65 lawyers or more in the room at one time, representing class actions, 23 or so, and some unlimited, I don't know the limit, 15 to 18,000 individual claims that were brought by people individually for their time in the residential school, the majority of which were Catholic schools run. Their estimates of 150,000 students across the country that went to these schools, mostly in the West, but in Ontario and Quebec, and sprinkling in the Maritimes, very few. There were several components to the settlement. One was a common experience payment. Everybody who attended was to receive $10,000 for 1 year or any part thereof, and then subsequent amounts for further attendance, $2,000 a year for any year. Some of these survivors spent 12 years in those schools. Many died. There were about 80,000 who survived. I'm giving gross figures here. And no amount of compensation can make up for liberty lost or opportunity lost. For denying your culture, you couldn't speak the language. You were given a number. Your hair was cut short. There was spare the rod and spoil the child kind of discipline. It was terrible. And then, of course, assault, physical and sexual. This was the mess. There was an independent assessment process. People could pursue their brutality claims in that independent assessment, not in court, but with adjudicators who would then listen to their story. They would not have the rules of court and all the technical rules of evidence, presentation, and so on, but they would have a process that was fair to determine. And it ended up that those damages for brutal treatment, physical assault, serious physical assault, and sexual assault were what you would get in a courtroom through a court process. And then there was money for intergenerational healing. They weren't students who went to the school, but they were children of the students who went to the school. And there was a healing foundation kind of approach for that. So that was a component. And then there was the setting up of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which the previous components were past-oriented, okay? The one for the future was the Truth and Reconciliation and a magnificent performance and job and report by former wonderful man, Murray Sinclair, unfortunately recently passed on. I was on the chair of the selection committee for him and was certainly thrilled with what he did. It is a recipe for the future. So that report should not gather dust on the shelves as many other Indigenous reports have. It has to be taken seriously. It's been taken seriously by a number of people outside government, schools and institutions have been private sector. Many examples and more to come, we hope. So when you put it all together, it was signed in principle in the firm that I'm presently having this podcast from, with many people signing on a Sunday midnight kind of thing, because it had to be signed and given to the federal government, because an election was going to be called, which was called. But the emotion of that signing was one of the most moving experiences I've had in my life. The last two to sign the agreement in principle were Phil Fontaine and myself, and both of us in our embrace of each other.
You had both put so much of yourselves and your energy and your time into that. As you spoke, I think listeners can hear how many interlocking and complicated pieces of history and the experience of survivors had to be listened to and taken into account. And at the same time, how many pieces of the response had to be imagined and then implemented in order to kind of acknowledge and then support survivors and their families and their communities. And I also think you've brought us right back to where we started and the significance of education, because of course, as you talked about, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's report meant to look forward, meant to have an impact on, among other things, educational institutions and the ways in which we learn in this country, and in particular in legal education, the ways in which law students learn from this legacy, from the response that you had a part in shaping, along with many others, and that law students, well, we've talked about this before, that from this story, you know, law students, I think, are invited to take on responsibility on their shoulders. And right back to also where you started, you know, this core of helping people, of finding ways to help, to move things forward, not to think you can do it on your own, but that you do have a special and important role to play. So thank you so much for that. I wonder, as we tie up, whether there are practices around you, projects that you're aware of, things happening in our world at the moment that give you hope for the future that you could share. And I might also ask you actually to tell your three workers story as we finish off.
I think there are some grounds for hope. And through this whole process of Indigenous work, for example, the best thing I feel of its product is the results for the people concerned, but also something that's really important, and that is the leadership of the Indigenous communities. They are increasingly well-educated. They are taking on leadership through insightful and impressive approaches to articulating what would be better for their people. This doesn't mean it's easily resolvable, but it does mean that there's an improvement, a great, great improvement to moving forward. Because in my view, Shauna, the relationship with Indigenous people is the most important societal issue facing Canada. If we can move the needle on that, and we are moving in that direction, it will make us an even better country. The three workers story I will end with. I heard this in a sermon when Nancy and I were in New York as fresh lawyers and just coming back from England with graduate studies. And it was in a church called Plymouth Church of the Pilgrims. And it was the church of an abolitionist who was against slavery and a well-known figure. And the minister of the day was giving this story about three workers. They were all working on a cathedral sort of building. And anyway, the first worker was asked by a passerby, "What are you doing?" And the first worker said, "I'm cutting stone." And then the passerby moved on and he said to a second worker, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I make $5 a day." And the third worker was asked by the passerby, "What are you doing?" And the reply was, "I'm building a cathedral." And it's a story that is told many times. Others have told it, but it fits. I think it was a judge who said, "Every calling is great when greatly pursued." And that was Holmes who said that. But that's what I think we should all think about. And whatever we're doing, we should think of what is that job in the perspective that is wider. And I don't mean we want to be insincere about what's going on or just be superficial about what we're working at. But there is a context that all of us should think about, that whatever we're doing has a wider, wider significance. And I think the three workers story, to my mind, is a good reminder of us to pause and think about.
It's wonderful to hear you share that story. Listeners will take from it inspiration, I think, to combine hard work with partnering with others, right, in the building of cathedrals, metaphorical or real, in our world. Frank, thank you so much for joining me today. It was truly an honor to speak with you, as always. I remember hearing you say once that for you, learning about the law and about justice is a lifelong experience. You went on to say, even for an old guy like me, I'm still learning. And our listeners are just so fortunate to have had a chance to learn from you today about law and justice through this conversation. So thank you so much, Frank.
I can't thank you enough, Shauna, for having me on this podcast. I greatly appreciate it. And continued success to you and your most important work. Bless you.
The Honorable Frank Iacobucci joined us from Toronto. That's it for this episode of Obiter, a project of the Law Commission of Canada. The Obiter team consists of producer Brian Peebles and editorial assistant David Dastou. Frédéric Sauvé is our associate producer and Farah Akhtar our project manager. Our sound designer and director is Dominique Girard. Our studio technician is Wayne Giesbrecht. Obiter is produced by Cascade Communications. I'm your host, Shauna Van Praagh. Thanks for listening.